So, humility. When we start off our statement of faith on our website, it doesn't say what it's supposed to say. What it's supposed to say, number one, we believe in God, the Father, the maker of heaven and earth. That comes all the way back from the Heidelberg Confession. That's been around for years. We don't say that. Instead, what we say is we believe in paradox. But because we believe in paradox, we believe in humility. In other words, we believe you can't contain this enormity that we call the divine, this enormity we call the spiritual life, in any construct that will hold together for any length of time. Consequently, we have to come to life, we have to come to the spiritual journey, we have to come to this construct we call God with humility. That is an insistence that our tradition has imposed upon us. You can't know God. You can't know what God does or doesn't do. You can't know what God is like or isn't like. You can't know who God favors or who God doesn't favor. God, our tradition insists, is beyond that. And the implication is the demand that we practice humility. The implication is that we insist of ourselves holding on to teachable hearts, an openness to other people, openness to ideas, openness to other metaphors for God, openness to curiosity. Well, that's where we began last week, revisiting our most ancient truths. Our tradition teaches us that the greatest sin has nothing to do with sex. The greatest sin has nothing to do with even ethics. Now, before I go on, you want to give a lot of attention to ethics. You want to give a lot of attention to how you practice your sexuality. It's saving you a whole bunch of pain. But, our tradition says, that's not the point. That's not the big problem. The greatest sin, the one that causes the most damage, is when we take that which cannot be contained, the divine, and we shoehorn it into a construct that we can hold in our heads. Because as soon as we do that, we, quote, know God. And when we know God, we know what God will do and what God won't do. We know who God favors and we know who God disfavors. And history is just chock full of painful, painful illustrations of how badly that goes for us when we do that. Once we have God figured, our next step, inevitably, is to work a plan so that we can get on God's side. More accurately, what we do is we figure out a plan to get God on our side, doing and disliking anything that we want to do or anyone that we want to dislike. So, we said last week, that's the first instruction of our tradition. Idolatry is what it's called. Don't do that. But our tradition is just full of the illustrations of us doing just that, trying to talk about that which cannot be talked about. So even though we cannot contain God any more than a box can contain the wind, we can nevertheless experience God just as we can experience wind. So the text that we read this morning, it spoke of the experience of accumulated generations, that when we experience the divine, we find our way into peace. That's not a doctrine, it's an experience. When we experience the divine, we find our way into love and into liberation. That's what our ancient writings tell us again and again. When we experience the divine, love and truth meet on our streets. Rightness and wholeness embrace and kiss. Truth sprouts green from the ground, and rightness pours down from the sky. These are experiential dynamics that our tradition says when the divine is in the mix, you have experiences. You don't have it figured out, but you have experiences. And they are relatively consistent across the generations, across the centuries. When people seek the divine, what they find is experience. Experiences like love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and self-control, the fruit of the indwelling Spirit of God. Experiences like courage and justice and compassion, liberation, a deep interior source that when we draw from it enables us to heal what is broken in our lives and in our homes and in our streets and in our cities. We can't experience the divine. We can't contain the divine. We can't hold God in any font that we think, any construct that we fashion that helps us understand, any metaphor that points us toward experience. And yet, we have said, all we have are these brains of ours, and all our brains can do is think thoughts and form mental constructs and generate metaphors, which, it turns out, is helpful for stumbling into one of religion's greatest points of beauty. Because when we try to talk about that which cannot be talked about, when we use effort to generate metaphors for the divine, our efforts at mental constructs to describe divine experience, these things are often, throughout history, the most beautiful thing that human beings do. Because they are often pointers toward experience. These metaphors point us toward the kinds of experiences that people have when they experience God. Now, the Buddhists illustrate this with the metaphor of a finger pointing at the moon. If our focus is riveted on the finger, we're kind of missing the point. The point is to look at what the finger is pointing us toward. Our metaphors for God point us toward an experience. But if we get fixated on the metaphor, we can actually miss the experience. Okay, that was last week. This week, I want to talk about some of the ways that we get riveted on the finger. Some of the metaphors that we fixate on that keep us from seeing the moon. There are common metaphors that are shared among us as people, as religious people, as American people, as Western people. And since they are commonly held among so many of us, it is helpful to know what they are so that we can stand back and examine them, see them for the benefits and experience that they grant us, see them for the blind spots that they impose upon us. Because what happens is these metaphors, as we've seen, they set up camp inside of our heads, and they can do all kinds of mischief. In addition to pointing us to the beauty of experience, they can also do a tremendous amount of mischief. So last week I said that when we get too invested in any one of our metaphors, when we get too locked into a specific, accurate, definite view of God, it will actually eliminate spiritual opportunity, it will actually eliminate spiritual possibility. You'll hear me say in a moment, what I say all the time, every yes is a no. If we say yes to one metaphor, we are by definition saying no to another, and we are shutting off experience. So, about 10 years ago, Baylor University did a study on American views of God. At that time, about 90% of us said that we believe in God, and when the study drilled in more deeply, it helped us understand that we do all believe in God, or 90% of us believe in God, but we don't believe in the same God. And the difference has primarily to do with the metaphors that we hold for God. It turns out that the metaphor that you have in your mind for God actually has very little to do with the religion that you follow. It has more to do with how you frame God than whether you are Christian or whether you are Muslim or whether you are Hindu. Many people in the same religion have very different views of God. Many people who are in different religions have the same view of God. So when it comes to how we practice our religion or who we practice it with, we sort ourselves and divide ourselves up, first according to the title of our tradition, I am Christian or I am Hindu or I am whatever, but second, and almost as significantly, we divide ourselves up along the lines of the kind of God that we construct in our minds. So 10 years ago, and again, that's going to be important, that 10 years ago part, because as we'll see in a moment, the trend has been toward change, and that trend has continued this last 10 years. 10 years ago, about 31% of us, Americans from all religious traditions, we held a metaphor in our minds for God that was authoritarian and disciplinarian. Authoritarian and disciplinarian. Wrath is the word often associated with that image of God. You've heard the term the wrath of God present in many of our songs in our own Christian tradition. 31% of Americans, this is the God we worship. Almost a quarter, 23% of us, have 10 years ago held in our minds a metaphor for God that is benevolent. This God is more forgiving. This God is a friend. This God is easier on sinners than the disciplinarian, authoritarian God. This God focuses on peacemaking, bridging the gap between people and bridging the gap between God and people. This God heals the wounded. This God cares for the downtrodden. So 10 years ago, almost a quarter of us worshipped this God. Another quarter of us, 10 years ago, thought about God using the metaphor of distance. You might have heard the metaphor of God as a clockmaker. Makes the clock, winds it up, and then leaves. And the clock just keeps running without much intervention from the clockmaker after that. This God is out there somewhere, got the universe going, but now operates more like the creator of the rules than the enforcer of the rules. So this God might show up when things wind down near the end, either wind it up again or say it's over, we're done. But for the most part, this God is not involved in our daily affairs. And that was 16% of us. Oh, I'm sorry, 25% of us. The next one, 16% of us then have this last metaphor for God. And that is the God who is quite judgmental. This God despises the injustice that happens on the earth. This God has heard the cries of people who are hurting. And this God, while seemingly distant today because evil continues to persist, this God will ultimately make things right in the end. This God has tools in his toolbox, heaven and hell, that this God will use to balance the scales, rewarding those who suffer righteously when they die and punishing those who cause suffering. So those are the four main metaphors that Americans have been working with for a long time. Now, as I said, the trend has been toward change. In the last 10 years, and in the two decades before that, people who formed their religious constructs in the last half of the 20th century were about a shift from one of those views to the other. And the primary shift was moving away from the authoritarian, disciplinarian God. Moving away from the stern, but ultimately loving, Father in heaven. The God who is demanding, but also righteous. The God that is fair, but also reasonable. The God who is a strict judge of wrongdoing. The trend has been away from that God. Away from a stern Father, a stern judge, to a more benevolent God. So we move from the first category primarily to the second. To a God who is less concerned about our getting our dogma right, less concerned about punishing wrongdoing, more concerned about rewarding good behavior, and more concerned about making life good for people. The study showed that as people made this transition from the authoritarian, disciplinarian God to the benevolent God, they still held to the concept of heaven and hell. They just stopped believing that anyone would go to hell. So when surveyed, they realized that only 1% of people in this benevolent God construct thought that they would go to hell, and the only 1% of them thought that their neighbors would go to hell either. So yeah, we have a hell, it's just empty. So in these last few decades, last three or four decades in American society, our God has become kinder and gentler. Less father and more mother. Less judge and more country doctor. More accepting of diversity, more open to exploration, finding new ways, more open to diversity of opinion. So, if you think about that, and think about our own community, that meta trend that's going on in society, and how it's worked out in our own community, we have done a great deal of work rethinking our Christian narrative, re-examining our Christian practices. Well, in many ways, that work was possible because many of us had been part of this overarching trend within our nation. There's more freedom to rethink and more freedom to reinterpret and more freedom to reconsider when the punitive consequences of doing so are diminished. You can afford to rethink God when God isn't going to whack you for doing so. You can afford to rethink God when God is more benevolent and more accepting of diversity of understanding. So, for many people, having made this shift from the authoritarian disciplinarian God to the benevolent God, it has actually advanced their spiritual lives and advanced their spiritual journeys. It has for me. I went through that process. For many of us, there is less fear, more availability to exploration, more willingness to explore other spiritual practices, other spiritual beliefs. One of the things you hear me say all the time is that forgiveness is to God as shine is to sun. That comes from having made this transition into the view of God as the benevolent God. When you were under the authoritarian, disciplinarian God, there was no guarantee that forgiveness would be afforded you. You had to jump through a whole lot of hoops in order to be forgiven. You had to say the right words to be forgiven. Now, with the benevolent God, we can say, you know, forgiveness, that's not the issue. Let's not put our energy there. Let's put it over here instead. So those kinds of things have a profound impact on the way that we live our spiritual lives. But they have a profound impact on the way we live in our homes, the way that we live on our jobs, the way that we carry about our lives. When the narrative of ultimacy speaks of the core of love or benevolence, it's a different world than when the narrative of ultimacy speaks of strict judgment, strict discipline. So, the shift to a more benevolent God has been life-giving for a whole lot of people in our generation. But remember what we said last week. Any metaphor for God that we internalize and then fix in place will, in the end, betray us. Because God cannot be contained in any metaphor, not even a wonderful one. God can't be contained in metaphors. So we look for experiences of the divine that match our metaphor, and if our metaphor is telling us, look over here, even if here is wonderful, even if when we look there we find rich and powerful, life-giving and transformative things, we're looking here, which means we're not looking here. And it turns out God can be found in this metaphor and this metaphor. So by saying yes to one, we are inevitably saying no to another once our constructs gets fixed. You hear me say that all the time. Every yes is a no, and yet here again. By configuring ourselves in one metaphor for one kind of experience of the divine, we can't help but close ourselves off to another. So, the benevolent God has helped us move beyond framing our lives as children trying to please a stern, loving father. The shift away from the authoritarian, disciplinarian God has helped us not limit our religions by being strict adherers to the rules. We've been able to exercise freedom and exploration, and we aren't trying to make sure that we follow the laws of the judge God. But in the process, and usually without realizing that we did so, we said no to some other things in other metaphors, but let's just talk about the one that we walked away from. What was available to us in the disciplinarian, authoritarian metaphor for God? Well, one of the things that was available in that God was embracing and integrating the concept of duty. The concept that we are called to make sacrifices on behalf of one another. That we are called to make sacrifices to our own well-being in order to serve something bigger than our well-being, the well-being of the whole, the well-being of the planet, the well-being of others. We learn duty, and we learn sacrifice, and we learn serving other people when we worship a strict authoritarian God. Also, the strict authoritarian disciplinarian God helped us give a wide berth to some really harmful behaviors. We called it sin. Or we thought of ourselves in that framework as living holy lives, or being set apart, or living a higher life. But in essence, what we did is we stayed away from a whole lot of stuff that would have hurt us very badly. And we taught our children to stay away from a whole lot of stuff that would have hurt us very badly. And so, we construct an image of God in our minds, it inevitably opens us to some wonderful things and can close us off from some other things. But what are we going to do about that? What do you do about the reality that no matter where we go, even to a wonderful, benevolent God kind of metaphor, it is going to ultimately betray us? God cannot be contained. Now, our motivation to pin God down, it's very understandable. What we want to do is just get it right. This is really important stuff. I want to get it right. And then once I get it right, I want to make sure that I live my life according to the way it's supposed to go. And that's a noble intent. The problem is our ancestors warned us. Yeah, we tried that. Don't do it. It isn't going to work well for you in the end. It doesn't, the spiritual life, it doesn't work that way. If a one and true truth about God were available to us, we might consider getting the answers right. But that's not an option. That is not one of the things accessible to us. That is not available to us. As much as we would like to get the answer right and then shape our lives so that we can live it the right way, trying to do that, our ancestors warn us, is an illusion. It's a mirage. It is a chase that if we go after it hard enough, will in the end betray us. We know that because whole generations before us have tried. They settled on the answer. Maybe they got it from the book. Before that, they got it from the Pope. Before they get that, they got it from the apostles and prophets. Maybe you grew up getting your right answer from the denomination or from the national consensus or wherever we go to get our right answer. In the end, it betrays us. The uncontainable nature of the divine requires that every generation, ours included, come to grips with the blind spots that are inherent in our view of ultimacy. We use the word God to talk about our view of ultimacy. Whatever we define as our metaphor for understanding that which is too big to be contained, every one of them will have a blind spot. And it becomes incumbent upon every generation to become apprised of our blind spots. Now, these stories that we tell ourselves about God, they create great beauty. These stories that we tell ourselves about God, they point us in the direction of experience. And it is a rich, profound, transformative experience. Praise be to God. And create blind spots. And keep us from something. And so every one of these, we would do well to be apprised of the story that we tell ourselves. That means that every generation, ours included, must learn the single most important spiritual skill, the skill of discernment. We might call it discerning the heart of God or discerning the mind of God. If our metaphor for God includes a heart or a mind, then we've got to discern what that is in the moment. Every generation tells a story of God. And every generation must work on that story and make sure that it is big enough and beautiful enough and inspiring enough for this moment, for this life, for this society, for this moment in the world. That's why the wise in every generation take up the curriculum that we talked about during the announcements. The practices that help us become discerning people. Spiritual people are discerning people. And it turns out that we discern better the blind spots in our metaphor as well as the richness in our metaphor. We discern it better when we do it together, when we engage in the communal practices. Maybe you see where the next few paragraphs are going. We've got a circle. We work that circle. There are communal practices. We discern better our blind spots and the richness of our God metaphor when we quiet our souls and we participate in the contemplative practices. We discern better both our blind spots and the richness of our metaphor when we're engaged in the learning practices and when we're engaged in the serving practices. Integrating these ancient rhythms into our lives, history has shown us, enhances this essential need to discern, enhances this essential capacity, what Jesus called eyes that will actually see, and ears that will actually hear. And so again, this fall, as we invite one another into groups that will practice the curriculum, beneath the surface of all of those practices, all of those groups, there is this drumbeat that says, it is essential that we discern. It is essential that we discern. Our tendency is to fix on something that's giving us life. But once we do that, we get life. Before long, we get blind spots. They come with. So, what we do in the spiritual life is we respond to the moment. We learn to discern the interior voice. We do the two-step dance of the spiritual journey. We desire deeply, and we pay attention. And so, the practices, the discernment, each generation's responsibility to discern our stories about the divine. Spirit of God, may we be discerning people, immersed in the rhythm of the ancient practices, discerning both the riches and the blind spots of our entrenched views of God. Be that so as we follow Jesus.